Good evening. I am Hank Jones. You are listening to Hank Jones Poly Sports here on Global Patriot Radio. Find us every day or most days at blogtalkradio.com, beginning Mondays with the Vito Esposito Show featuring Vito and Big Al. Mama Mia No Sharia, that's every Monday at 6 p.m. Tuesdays, Flux right now. Wednesdays, it's me, Hank Jones, 6 p.m. Eastern Time, Hank Jones Poly Sports. We talk politics, we talk sports, and we address those unfortunate times when the two collide. Thursdays, spot duty. I'll do hankerings once in a while. I'm doing another one tomorrow. I am going to do it at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to sort of put to rest would be better, not putting it to bed, the Obama paddleboard story. And I have some interesting stuff actually up tomorrow on it because of a couple situations I had this week that kind of bear out my feelings on this whole situation. Fridays, right now, nothing going on. Trying to find a replacement. Saturday nights, 10 p.m. to midnight, Minister Usama Dakduk and the beautiful Christy revealing the truth about Islam. And then Sundays, not sure if Eric's going to be back. He's had some issues with some scumbags getting on the show. And so just there's that. So that's our week, and we are filling them as soon as possible the other days. But in the meantime, you are here, Hank Jones Poly Sports. To get in touch with the show at any time, email me, hjpsports1980@gmail.com. Head over to Facebook and just type in Hank Jones Poly Sports. I got a page there. I don't do a lot on it, but hey, I go there every day to get my free Candy Crush power up or whatever you want to call it. Twitter, at hpolysports. It's been active today. Somebody was asking about some fraud stuff and flipping voters. And I made the point that key element has nothing to do with flipping Biden supporters. It's not important because there aren't anywhere near 81 million Biden supporters. It's stopping the fraud that is crucial to this next presidential election, and frankly, all future elections. Meanwhile, I'm here hanging out, the official Hank Jones Poly Sports Space Force Observation Outpost. Little Aussie, my little mini Aussie has been fed. She was crashed out next to me, but no storms right now, so obviously she feels comfortable heading out to the rest of the house. Hank's better half is still working remotely. She's house and pet sitting for our daughter and son-in-law out in Seattle while they are overseas at a wedding of a friend. Rough life, huh? I always do destination weddings in Europe. Today's first internet laughy. Megan Rapinoe gets a new job training stormtroopers how to shoot. Yeah, if you don't know the story, Megan Rapinoe, the anti-American soccer player, the anti-everything soccer player, missed a penalty shootout, a penalty kick in a shootout, and the U.S. went down in flames in the Women's World Cup. It's all over Twitter, people talking about, I'm rooting for everyone else but the U.S. That's kind of sad. Really, but second internet laughy, also from the Babylon Bee, Wayne Brady comes out as needing attention. In case you haven't heard, Wayne Brady made this announcement that he is pansexual. I still don't know what the hell that means. It means that you're attracted to whoever. It's the relationship, not the sexual or something like that, that you can be attracted to anyone. I don't think it includes animals or children, but it is part of the whole LGBTQIA whatever alphabet soup that comes with that. LG and B, I have no problem with. I mean, no, I'm not a lesbian, obviously, and I'm not gay, and I'm not bisexual, but I get that people are what they are. Trans, no, I'm not. Especially when it comes to bio males competing as women, that's not transgender. That's sick. Last week's losses that I deem significant. Gosh, who is going after me? Oh, okay. Hawkeye Mike makes a good point. How is that any different than the old mantra, if it feels good, do it? Yeah, well, except that I think they're, I don't know. It's weird. The whole thing's weird. Last week's losses that I deem significant. And when I say significant, I'm talking about, you know, obituaries that are kind of, you know, semi-important, I guess you'd say, or semi-notable. How's that? That would be the better way to put it, semi-notable. Last Wednesday, we lost Tater Tot at the age of 6. For those wondering, that was an internet celebrity cat, Tater Tot, gone from the animal kingdom and our greater planet at the age of 6. So, gosh, I'm getting it. I'm getting other stuff from people now. Okay, well, I'm going to have to leave my phone alone for a little bit. Why? Because people are messaging me, not just Hawkeye Mike I'll take, but other ones are coming up. Last Thursday, we lost actor Mark Margolis, 83. He was in both of the Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul series, as well as he appeared in several Darren Aronofsky films. Of course, he played a great gangster, mobster character whenever he was on TV or the big screen. He also actually had a role in one of my favorite non-notable but great flicks. It's called Squanto, A Warrior's Tale. I know, it sounds cheesy. Kind of is. Squanto was a Native American who evidently was kidnapped and taken overseas, taken back to England, I think, and then escaped and got to Spain and then made his way back to the U.S. and discovered that most of his tribe, if not all, were gone. And it's famine and disease and warring factions. It's actually a good film. I like watching it around Thanksgiving. I like watching those films that sort of tell that tale of old America, pre-America. Anyway, until Mark Margolis started receiving Emmy nominations, he was among the better of those in what I would used to call, and including Hawkeye Mike, the VCA category, veteran character actor. Great actor. I loved his stuff. Now, Friday, we lost keyboarder John Gosling at the age of 75. His most notable work was with the Kinks. Then Saturday, we were given the news of the death of model/singer Carmen Extravaganza to lung cancer at age 62. Again, given the name, I was pleasantly surprised to learn she was not a porn star. Sunday, we lost former NHL goalie Gilles Gilbert at age 74. He spent his career with three teams, the Minnesota North Stars. That's changed. Teams moving around. The Boston Bruins and the Detroit Red Wings. He was most notable for his performance with the Bruins, along with Jerry Cheevers. They were runners-up for the Vezina Trophy in 1980. Yeah, Monday we lost keyboarder David LaFlamme at the age of 82. His signature work was with the group It's a Beautiful Day for their hit White Bird. And we also lost DJ and songwriter DJ Casper to kidney and liver cancer at age 58. His most notable work was the Cha-Cha Slide. The answer to that is no. Just no. Not gonna go there. Not going to play that one for you. And then sadly, we lost Oscar-winning director William Friedkin to heart failure and pneumonia at age 87. He won an Oscar for Best Director for the very awesome flick The French Connection, which featured one of the all-time great chase scenes. Other Friedkin films included The Boys in the Band, The Brinks Job, Cruising, and To Live and Die in L.A. Today we learned of the death of Robert Swan, actor Robert Swan, to cancer at age 78. Among numerous roles, he played one of those stern fathers in the movie Hoosiers. Remember, he was the father of one of the sons that left. Remember, there's two guys and they're talking, and Gene Hackman's character says, "Is there something you want to share?" And he says, "We're just wondering when things are going to get started." And he kicks him off. And then Robert Swan was the father of the guy that he brings his son back, basically says, "My son's sorry," and apologize. And the kid apologizes. And then fathers are there trying to interfere. And he says, "Just leave him alone. He's got a job to do." He also appeared in the films Backdraft and Natural Born Killers. Hey, don't forget my friends at Alliance Communications, Central Florida's 24-hour call center, messaging and answering services for your medical clinic, hospital clinic, information gathering services, large and small service companies, information gathering, surveys, and do it all. And they also work with remote staff, which is a real advantage. In times like this in the summer in Florida, you get hurricanes. Well, they've got remote staff, so hurricanes aren't really an issue for them, staffing-wise. And if you're one of those that likes doing remote work, you could be that could be a good fit for you. And if you're one of those didn't go back to the office after COVID, just said forget it, forget the rent, forget the headaches of an office, you still need a front line. You still need someone to take those calls. Alliance Communications can do that for you and do it very well. Give them a call, 800-555-3738, or visit their website, alliancecommunications.com. Another internet laughy from the Babylon Bee. I would say it's kind of cruel, but it's not, and it's very appropriate. Democrats hire professional puppeteer. Hired to continue operating Dianne Feinstein. Yeah, I'll tell you why that's significant. She's been in the hospital again, evidently. And so she's... She's being puppeteered, basically. That's what it is. Hey, other ways to interact with the show, you can come in and listen online and just hit live. It'll take you to a page. You go down to the corner and you look up chatters or live chatters, and it'll tell you what shows are on and who's got a chat room open. Duck Northwest Media is in that chat room right now. So you can listen or you can chat, both passive or active, or you can call in, of course, 319-527-6706. They're right now listening, including Hawkeye Mike, first in today, my sister, my big sister up in the Northeast, and then Sue from New Mexico. Welcome back, Sue. Haven't seen you in a while. Seen you on Twitter, of course, but good to see everyone here. So let's get to what's going on. Looks like the Ron DeSantis presidential campaign is running into some problems. First, a major donor withheld support unless good old RDS moves to a more moderate position. Yeah, that won't happen. And also now he has removed his campaign manager, Janera Peck, placed her with his former gubernatorial chief of staff, James Uthmeyer. Now, Janera Peck is staying on as chief strategist. The campaign is also adding strategist David Poljanski of the Super PAC Never Back Down. Yeah, he's brought in because basically neither Peck nor Uthmeyer has national campaign experience. David Poljanski does. He worked on some failed campaigns, but campaign work nonetheless. It's also been announced that Fox News' Sean Hannity will be moderating a, quote, high-stakes debate, unquote, between Ron DeSantis and California Governor Gavin Newsom. Which could be real interesting. On the one side, DeSantis could be positioning himself for a VP slot or other cabinet-level position, while Newsom is obviously looking for a way to worm himself into the national scene any way he can, either as a Dem challenger to Dopey Joe or possible replacement for Kamala Harris, in which case he would then become the de facto president. Massachusetts Governor Maura Healey has declared a state of emergency in response to the influx of migrants and refugees into Massachusetts. Apparently, it affects 5,600 families and over 20,000 people within that state's shelter system. Now, while it's being attributed to federal policies relating to immigration and work authorization and lack of affordable housing and the cessation of COVID-era programs, we all know, come on, this is really just a request for a handout from La Dopey Nostra. It's not like they're worried about finding any actual money to pay for this kind of stuff. It's really just a broader handout request from places like Illinois and New York and New Jersey and the other states who have bitten off more than they can chew. Now, if I was a betting man, my money would be on some sort of request for immediate citizenship and voting access. That's not how the request is framed, of course, but... And while those requests wouldn't do a damn thing for the actual freeloaders and illegals and other handout seekers, it would be a way to try and grab more power via illegal voting schemes. That's what that's about, folks. So when you see that, you're going to see probably in your, if you're like me, you get a bunch of different email newsletters and daily updates. And that's in there. It says, I think, red state governor emergency request or something. That's all it is. It's nothing huge. It's not a, there's no disaster going on there other than the man-made disaster of allowing people to enter in through their state who have no business being here, aren't in a position to support themselves or their families. They're not fleeing they're fleeing other states or countries, but they're not coming in through the normal channels, which would mean coming to the border. See, and Hawkeye Mike would probably be able to explain this, and he'll be on later, but when somebody leaves a country and seeks asylum, you seek asylum in a neighboring country. You don't seek asylum four countries away. So you don't leave Colombia or Venezuela or El Salvador and come directly to the United States. You go to a neighboring country. That's how it's supposed to work. But, of course, it's not. They just come straight here. Barack Obama's brother, Malik, has made a couple social media posts in recent weeks in response to Barack's defense, one of them in response to Barack's defense of children's library books that include material on explicitly gay themes. Quoting a letter that Barack posted, Malik responded with, "This guy must be gay." Now, that comes roughly the same time as one of Obama's biographers who referenced some letters that Barack wrote to a former girlfriend in which he said he fantasized about having sex with other men. Whatever, like I said. While the post itself was no big deal, some of the responses, two of them actually, were hilarious. One said, "He's not gay, but his boyfriend is." Oh, my God. That should have been an internet laughing, huh? The other one said, "Careful, Malik. Don't want to be in a paddleboarding accident." Yeah, by the way, like I said, I'll be doing a hankerings tomorrow on that. I'm going to conclude some thoughts on that situation. Here's a story from Patriot Alerts that ought to make us all feel safe and warm and cozy. Here's the headline. This is uplifting. U.S. sends destroyers to Alaska after Russian and Chinese ships' unprecedented aggression in American waters. I don't know about that, but Russia and China dispatched a combined naval force near the coast of Alaska last week, marking a historical first in the face of rising global tensions. The U.S. responded by sending four destroyers to monitor the situation as a result, according to the Wall Street Journal. 11 Russian and Chinese ships steamed close to the Aleutian Islands, according to U.S. officials. Great, I'm going on an Alaska cruise in a couple months. The ships, which never entered U.S. territorial waters, were overshadowed by four U.S. destroyers and P-8 Poseidon aircraft. Brent Sadler, a senior research fellow at the Heritage Foundation and a retired Navy captain, described the move as highly provocative. He stated, given the context of the war in Ukraine and tensions around Taiwan, this move is highly provocative. This sentiment echoes the concerns of many international observers who see this joint naval patrol as a clear signal of Russia and China's willingness to challenge the United States' dominance in the region. It's not dominance in the region, it's our water. Now, they were saying they're in international waters, also known as the high seas, begin 12 nautical miles from the coast of any country and are open to all states, whether coastal or landlocked. Quote, but to see these combatants form up in a surface action group together and steam together, that's what's rare, according to Rear Admiral Nathan Moore, who was Coast Guard commander for the Alaska region until last month. I didn't even look, but I'll bet you that dude was a holdover from the Trump administration and was removed so Russia and China could have access. Naval patrol by Russia and China near Alaska, but did not specify the number of ships or their precise location. Command said, air and maritime assets under our commands conducted operations to assure the defense of the United States and Canada. The patrol remained in international waters and was not considered a threat. The Russian Defense Ministry stated that the joint patrol had covered more than 2,300 nautical miles, including operations in the Sea of Japan and the Sea of Okhotsk. The Chinese embassy in Washington clarified that the patrol was not aimed at Washington. The embassy stated, according to the annual cooperation plan between the Chinese and Russian militaries, naval vessels of the two countries have recently conducted joint maritime patrols in relevant waters in the western and northern Pacific region. This action is not targeted at any third party and has nothing to do with the current international and regional situation. Pentagon Press Secretary Brigadier General Pat Ryder stated, at no point in time were they deemed to pose a threat. And so, like any country, they are free to conduct exercises in international airspace, international waters. Alaska Senators Lisa Murkowski and Dan Sullivan, both Republicans, spoke out against the exercise in statements while reiterating their call for more military funding for their state. They emphasized the strategic importance of Alaska in U.S. national defense and called for a stronger military presence in the region to counter potential threats. The joint Russian and Chinese naval patrols are part of a broader great power competition in the Arctic and northern climes, which is increasingly becoming contested territory. Let's get to that Feinstein thing real quick. Had a fall in San Francisco. The aged and long-serving Golden State politician is now in the hospital after a tripping and falling accident in San Francisco, TMZ reported. Yeah, we'll probably get more truth out of TMZ. Feinstein has already been through a spout of recent ailments, such as shingles, Ramsey-Hunt syndrome, and encephalitis that forced her to take a 3-month absence from the Senate just earlier this year alone. Senator Feinstein, a 90-year-old, exhibited signs of dementia when she denied her absence from the Senate and appeared confused at Senate hearings. TMZ writes that it is not aware of whether the injuries sustained from the fall were serious or not, and that Feinstein's press office has not responded to their inquiries. One health incident occurred when she began a speech on the Senate floor during the voting period on the bill itself. She began to say that, I would like to support a yes vote on this. It provides when Senator Patty Murray, Democrat of Washington, interrupted her to tell her, just say aye. One of Feinstein's aides also spoke to the confused senator. Last year, Feinstein was confused about why Kamala Harris, the vice president of the United States and a fellow Californian, was in the Senate. What is she doing here? Reportedly asked Feinstein, appearing unaware that the vice president is the presiding officer of the United States Senate. Harris was also a fellow senator from California from 2017 to 2021. Feinstein's health episodes have led many of her fellow party members to call on her to resign and retire from public life. Feinstein herself has said she will not seek re-election in 2024. She actually didn't say that. Her staff did. KNRS reported that Feinstein also gave her only child, Catherine, 66, power of attorney over her recently, according to a document posted by Insider earlier this month, which raised questions amid a growing number of both Democrats and Republicans calling for her resignation. The decision comes amid a family dispute over Feinstein's intention to sell her beach house near San Francisco, a decision being opposed by the children of her late husband, Richard C. Blum, according to the San Francisco Chronicle. Feinstein has been senator from the Golden State since 1992. The senator is not the only politician with public health issues. Senator John Fetterman, Democrat of Pennsylvania, stayed in the hospital for 66 days over clinical depression. Fetterman suffered a massive stroke back in May of 2022 that left him with, quote, overwhelming depression and a myriad of other problems, including severe auditory comprehension deficiencies. Remember this? Remember that? You do, of course, because this is what he hears every time anyone talks to him. Yeah, it's Fetterman. Senator Mitch McConnell, minority leader, also appeared to have a health episode on camera recently. Yeah, so amidst Russia and China cruising around off our coast, and I don't care if international waters are 12 miles. But yeah, that's who we got taking up the cause in the Senate. I mean, really? Here's what's scary about that. They obviously have no regard for our sovereignty, and they are obviously showing aggression by doing that. They say it's not, but I mean, the best we can do, I know we sent some destroyers and we sent aircraft, that's fine, but we need to be a little more forceful. Folks, this doesn't happen under President Trump. It simply doesn't. And like I said, I should look up that guy. While we're here, I'm going to Google Nathan Moore. I am going to see when he was appointed or whatever. Okay. So we're pulling him up. Huh. Oh, I see. He took the duties of the Atlantic area. So, okay. We're going to look him up. So this is, I mean, again, he's an engineer, blah, 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 cutter man. So he was deputy commander and chief of staff of Coast Guard Pacific Area from 2019 to 2021, or from, two, I'm sorry, 17 to 19, 20, 19 to 21, assistant commander for engineering and logistics. Wow. Yeah, something tells me that he was moved off of that. Maybe not, though. Maybe it's just an upward and outward or whatever. From Archimax. Previously, I've only used Archimax to get daily jokes and daily comics. I get the old Peanuts classics. I get BC, Blondie, Family Circus. Family Circus is hilarious. And so they reported on this. This is their version of a report. The Supreme Court revives federal rules against, quote, ghost, unquote, guns, or ghost guns, quote. Supreme Court on Tuesday granted an emergency appeal from the Biden administration and revived federal rules that forbid the sale or use of assembled guns that can be bought online and are untraceable. The justices set aside a Texas judge's order from last month that had voided the federal rule on these ghost guns. The vote was 5-4. The dissenting justices were Thomas, Alito, Gorsuch, and Kavanaugh, which means Amy Coney Barrett voted for it, amongst others. Gun rights dispute does not turn on the Second Amendment, but it has great practical significance. That's what it actually says. Police in California say ghost guns have been surging in number and put lethal weapons in the hands of criminals and teenagers who cannot legally buy a gun from a licensed dealer. U.S. Solicitor General Elizabeth Preligar appealed to the High Court on July 27th and urged the justices to lift the nationwide order handed down by U.S. District Judge Reed O'Connor in Fort Worth. He ruled in favor of several Texas gun owners and a gun dealer who argued the Gun Control Act of 1968 and its definition of a firearm does not extend to the unassembled parts of a working gun. Preligar described this ruling as far-fetched and dangerous. She said, unless repealed, it would allow anyone with access to the internet to anonymously buy a parts kit or partially completed frame or receiver and easily assemble a working firearm in as little as 20 minutes, she said. That would virtually repeal the core provisions of the federal firearms laws. And by making untraceable guns freely available to felons, minors, and other prohibited persons, it would endanger the public and thwart efforts to prevent and solve serious crimes. Last year, the White House announced a crackdown on ghost guns and revised the federal definition of a firearm to make clear that a parts kit that allows a purchaser to readily assemble an operational weapon is a firearm. Every speaker of English would recognize that a tax on sales of bookshelves applies to IKEA when it sells boxes of parts and the tools and instructions for assembling them into bookshelves, the Solicitor General said in her appeal in the case of Garland versus Vanderstock. The district judge's insistence on treating guns differently contradicts ordinary usage and makes a mockery of Congress. Congress's careful regulatory scheme, she said. Yeah, Congress didn't hand this down. La Dopey Nostra did. California state attorneys joined the D.C. and 13 other states in urging the Supreme Court to revive the federal rules on ghost guns. They said that even in states such as California that forbid the manufacture and sale of weapons with no serial numbers, the previous federal inaction has enabled individuals to circumvent state gun laws and bring unserialized weapons into the very states that have been trying to keep them out. For example, even though California has attempted to curb unserialized guns since at least 2016, these weapons accounted for nearly 30% of all guns recovered in the state by the BATF. Meanwhile, the number of unserialized guns recovered by California law enforcement agencies increased from 167 in 2016 to nearly 12,900 in 2022, a 77-fold increase. Supreme Court agreed earlier to hear arguments this fall on whether persons who are subject to restraining orders for domestic violence lose their rights to have guns. In that case, U.S. versus Raimi, the administration is appealing a Fifth Circuit ruling that held such orders violate the Second Amendment. As usual, in an effort to allegedly designed to take guns away from criminals, the La Dopey Nostra essentially seeks to abridge or eliminate the Second Amendment rights of all citizens, law-abiding citizens. I'm not sure how many times or how many ways it can be said, but I'll do it so again. Criminals don't obey gun laws. There would be a lot of reasons for someone to want to do this legally. People to know about their guns. They don't want retailers to know. They don't want to be part of a registry. I don't get it. But again, this is not going to go away. The Second Amendment is not going to go away, and the fight against it is not going to go away, in spite of the fact that it's a constitutionally guaranteed right. Mike Pence's former national security advisor slammed him on Truth Social, same time he endorsed President Trump. This is interesting. Former Pence advisor rips old boss over Trump comments. Former 48th Vice President Mike Pence, his national security advisor Keith Kellogg, reportedly criticized his former boss on Monday, saying he was unworthy of the presidency. He said, I've worked alongside many leaders in my years of service to this nation. Among them, President Donald J. Trump stands apart as a figure of unwavering determination a deep vision for America and the courage to take a stand where others will not. His bold and dramatic leadership style during his presidency resulted in significant achievements for our country. For a period of time in the White House, I served as a national security advisor to Vice President Pence. While I respect his service to our nation, I must express my disappointment in his recent actions regarding President Trump. It is not the decisive leadership that we have seen from President Trump. Where President Trump is bold and unafraid to challenge the status quo, Pence has often chosen the passive route, avoiding confrontation. This lack of assertiveness, combined with an over-reliance on failed political consultants like Mark Short, demonstrated a laissez-faire leadership style unworthy of the presidency. He followed up his criticism of Pence with praise of former President Trump. That is not what Republican voters want. President Trump's dedication to the prosperity and security of the United States is unwavering, as is his vision for the future. I believe in the future President Trump envisions, a future that demands bold and decisive leadership, something we have seen in President Trump, but not from the former vice president. Just a few days before that, President Trump had insulted Pence and said he had, quote, gone to the dark side. Pence is currently polling well behind former President Trump and current Florida Governor Ron DeSantis in the race for the GOP primary nomination. Yeah, DeSantis is well behind Trump as well, folks. Look, I'm not anti-DeSantis. I like him as a governor. I think he would be a good president. I just don't think it's his time right now. And frankly, I want him to stay in Florida as our governor. I'll put it this way. For those that are saying that are anti-Trump, there are those that are saying, all I see from Trump is somebody who's running on a revenge tour. Problem with that idiotic notion, folks. You're already seeing a revenge tour of sorts, or a tour of vengeance. It's a revenge tour from the standpoint of the Clintons and the Obamas and not getting Hillary Rotten Clinton into the White House after the 2016 election. That's the revenge tour. They're going after President Trump on any basis. And that leads to my next item in what can only, in my mind, be described as absurd and beyond reasonable from American Action News. Twitter fined $350,000 as DOJ looks for access to Trump's account. Special Counsel Jack Smith recently acquired a search warrant for former President Trump's Twitter account, according to newly disclosed court records. The warrant was related to an undisclosed investigation, and it was served with a non-disclosure order, meaning Twitter was prohibited from telling anyone about the warrant's existence. This has only recently come to public attention with the release of these documents, court documents. Twitter, now known as X, initially resisted complying with the warrant by challenging the non-disclosure order. However, this challenge was unsuccessful, leading to delays in delivering the required information. As a result, a federal judge fined the company $350,000 for contempt, and the decision was later upheld by a federal appeals court in Washington, D.C. A redacted version of the appellate court's opinion was released, unveiling this previously unreported legal battle. Why are we getting all these previously unreported and redacted? The legal struggle culminated in Twitter's eventual compliance with the warrant, but not without additional delays. Trump's Twitter account was only turned over to Smith's investigation 3 days after the court ordered deadline. A three-judge panel of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals dismissed Twitter's argument that the non-disclosure order was in violation of the First Amendment and that the warrant should have been stopped until the dispute was resolved, further affirming the court's decisions in the case. Am I missing something here? Is it me? Does the Department of Justice not have people who comb the social media accounts of anyone and everyone who is not in lockstep with the new Reich? My God, these people have no shame. But here's why I have a problem with it beyond the warrant. Look, while social media itself isn't private, messages certainly are implied to be private or direct messages between two people. to people, piercing that veil should be a hell of a lot more burdensome than a simple warrant. A private message or a social media post is hardly criminal in and of itself. Worse than that, the fact that the Department of Justice thinks people are stupid enough to advocate for criminality or mere obstruction by using a social media network implies we're okay with the idea of them having access in the first place. I get that it's social media, it's the internet, but that doesn't mean that, I mean, they're combing it anyway. Doesn't mean they have access to all parts of it. Doesn't mean they have access or the right to question what you say on social media. Worse, though, worst of all, in my opinion, given the recent history of the FBI, the Department of Justice, and others, how the data is manipulated by them leaves me with no trust that any agency will take access without manipulating, or worse, manufacturing criminal behavior within a post or within a private message. The Department of Justice, as we know it, is no longer a government agency. It's a professional fishing outfit. They literally go and fish. They use warrants to fish. What happened with the FISA courts with the Russia collusion? They literally manufactured a dossier, manipulated it in order to gain FISA warrants. They make stuff up in order to gain warrants. Here's the problem. Again, how far back has this gone? People say, well, they didn't used to. Things like when they took down the mob or when they took down this person, they didn't do it. How do we know that? We don't. We've heard a lot of stuff. We found out a lot of stuff about J. Edgar Hoover. I mean, consider this. When you have mobsters, real criminals, but mobsters who have been unjustly, illegally imprisoned because of how cases are conducted, that tells you something. See, we think it won't happen. We think, well, it only happens if you break the law. Obviously, it doesn't. The Russia collusion hoax proved that. The Russian collusion hoax proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that these people either A, think they're above the law, or think it can be situationally or strategically applied. I'm going to ask Mike this when he's on, but you know, it gets to the part of the gambling stuff that's happening in the state of Iowa. And what I mean by that is this. We're not hearing about any other people that have been targeted. It's only been athletes. How come nobody else has been investigated or charged? You telling me no other college students are gambling, legally or otherwise? Telling me every other college student, non-athlete college student in the state of Iowa is not illegally gambling? So it's targeting, to use a football term. It's targeting. That's what they're doing here. But my God, the Department of Justice having access to someone's social media via warrant means they're going to dig. And they're going to look for stuff. And guess what? When they don't find it, they start making stuff up. We've seen that. They've proven it. God. An article on the Epoch Times site that says certain people are ineligible for payment in the Facebook settlement, where the company admitted to sharing user data without permission. I'm guessing anyone who posted, shared, or liked anything conservative will somehow be excluded. Facebook/Meta working with the court system. It's about as reliable and trustworthy as Dopey Joe walking across a stage at a graduation ceremony. I still watch that. I don't feel bad about it. I still watch that. I'm saying it right here and now. I still pull that up on YouTube 2-3 times a week. It's hilarious. Oh, here's good news, I guess. Philadelphia's Made in America Festival, featuring singer and grossly overweight bikini model Lizzo, has been canceled, according to the Epic Times. Yeah. I'm pulling it up here. Y'all know who Lizzo is. She's recently been, there have been allegations of sexual harassment and sexual misbehavior, Lizzo. And so there's this festival put on by, the cryptic message on social media and its website Tuesday, Rock Nation, ROC, abruptly announced that its 2023 Made in America Festival has been canceled. Scheduled for September 2nd and 3rd, the event was to feature headliner performers Lizzo and SZA. Due to severe circumstances outside of production control, the 2023 Made in America Festival will no longer be taking place, the announcement said, adding that the decision was difficult, not made lightly, nor without immense deliberation. Rock Nation was founded in 2008 by Sean Jay-Z Carter, also promised all ticket holders would be refunded at the original point of purchase. Ticket seller Live Nation was not selling tickets Tuesday and was emailed a comment request for more details from the Epic Times. The already updated Made in America Wikipedia page said that the festival hopes to return in 2024. It's a Philadelphia tradition since 2012. Been held at Benjamin Franklin Parkway, featuring major acts such as Mariah Carey, Pearl Jam, Nine Inch Nails, Beyonce, Imagine Dragons, Kanye West, Weezer, Pharrell Williams, The Weeknd, and Justin Bieber. Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney told the Epic Times in an email statement, "I'm disappointed to hear that the 2023 Made in America Festival will no longer be taking place. Since 2012, it's grown into a Philly tradition on Labor Day weekend. Blah, blah, blah. We're grateful for all the partners." Rapper, songwriter, and actress Lizzo, whose real name is Melissa Vivian Jefferson, saw her popularity plummet in recent days after allegations of sexual harassment, fat shaming, that's weird, and a hostile work environment became public in a lawsuit brought by three former backup dancers. The three claimed Ms. Jefferson pressured them to take part in live sex shows in Amsterdam's red light district. She lost 220,000 Instagram followers in a matter of days, but still has some 13 million followers. In a statement on the site, Lizzo called the allegations false. "These last few days have been gut-wrenchingly difficult and overwhelmingly disappointing. My work ethic, morals, and respectfulness have been questioned. My character has been criticized. Usually I choose not to respond to false allegations, but these are as unbelievable as they sound and too outrageous to not be addressed. These sensationalized stories are coming from former employees who have already publicly admitted that they were told their behavior on tour was inappropriate and unprofessional. As an artist, I have always been very passionate about what I do. I take my music and my performances seriously because at the end of the day, I only want to put out the best art that represents me and my fans." Good God. "With passion comes hard work and high standards." Really? "Sometimes I have to make hard decisions, but it's ever my intention to make anyone feel uncomfortable or like they aren't valued as an important part of the team." I think there's a misprint there because it says it's ever her intention. I mean, okay, she says, "I'm not here to be looked at as a victim, but I also know that I am not the villain that people in the media have portrayed me to be these last few days. I'm very open with my sexuality and expressing myself, but I cannot accept or allow people to use that openness to make me out to be something I am not. There is nothing I take more seriously than the respect we deserve as women in the world. I know what it feels like to be body shamed on a daily basis and would absolutely never criticize or terminate an employee because of their weight. I'm hurt, but I will not let the good work I've done in the world be overshadowed by this." Good work, huh? Okay. Some of her fans commented that declaring herself, quote, open with her sexuality was not an effective way to respond to a sexual harassment claim. They say it's unclear but unlikely that the situation Ms. Jefferson faces is connected to the cancellation of the Made in America Festival, as it had many other artists booked. I have but one response to the festival. Thank you. Thank you. Anything that gets Lizzo off of screens and airwaves is a gift. Wow. Just to show that Ron DeSantis is not reticent about taking action, here is news that he has removed another Soros-backed prosecutor from office. According to the Daily Wire, he removed Monique Worrell. That's the second one. He threw out, what was his name? He threw out a guy. Oh, Andrew Warren, that's right, from the 13th. So Monique Worrell, just this past weekend, she was at the center of a major controversy. Dayton Veal was arrested in March 2023 for sexual battery on a minor, as well as lewd and lascivious molestation. That arrest was made while Veal was on probation for another offense. That probation began in February 2023. Veal was still let out on bond and thereafter shot two Orlando police officers. Yeah, that happened last weekend. In November 2022, 17-year-old Lorenzo Larry shot and killed his pregnant girlfriend, DeShayla Ferguson. Larry had previously been arrested in May 2022 on several charges, including carrying a concealed firearm, possession of a firearm on school property, and criminal possession of a firearm by a minor. But he was released after all these arrests. Worrell's office did not act on any of these charges until after he killed his girlfriend and their unborn child. In February 2023, 19-year-old Keith Moses shot and killed a cameraman and a 90-year-old girl. He had a long history of arrests as a juvenile, including aggravated battery, assault, and grand theft. As recently as November 2021, he was arrested for drug possession, but no charges were pursued. In October 2022, a minor was arrested on first-degree murder charges with a firearm. The shooting was captured on video. 1 month later, Worrell's office inexplicably filed a petition to reduce the charge to firearm possession. He was released on probation. The governor announced that he was appointing Judge Andrew Bain to take over Worrell's duties as state attorney for the Ninth Judicial Circuit. It's exactly 1 year after he removed state attorney Andrew Warren from the 13th District, both of whom were backed for election by George Soros. This is but one example, folks, of why I want Ron DeSantis to stay in Florida as governor through the completion of his second term. He takes no BS from Big Left, and despite the hue and cry recently of convention business canceling because of various policies and laws enacted under his leadership, he won't compromise when it comes to sound principles. He will not compromise just to get convention business to Florida. Frankly, as a Florida resident, I don't mind some of the traffic relief anyway. Yeah, so yeah, that's why I say I'm a big fan of Ron DeSantis. I don't want him as our next presidential candidate, but I want him as a presidential candidate at some point. Before I go to break, an internet laughy. DoorDash, the picture is awesome. DoorDash now operating pickle jar opening service to single women. I laugh because I did some DoorDash deliveries. I still do them on occasion. I haven't done them in a while, but I do them on occasion. Hey, let's welcome T. Bodie to the phones and bringing it boy to the chat room. How's it going, all? Going to take a quick break, and I'm coming back with Hawkeye Mike. We are going to talk about all this realignment in college football. Folks, whether or not you like college football, this is big stuff in the sense that it's just throwing everything upside down. But we'll be back in a tribute to our late director, William Friedkin. I give you this from The French Connection. This is Subway. are back on Hank Jones Poly Sports. That was Don Ellis, the conductor and trumpeter from the French Connection. It's called Subway. It's that there's two parts where they play it. One early on when Roy Scheider and Gene Hackman are tailing Sal Boca, for those that have seen the movie, refreshing your memory, played by Tony LoBianco. And then later when Fernando Rey is coming out of his hotel and Gene Hackman realizes he's been made, so he's tailing him. And that's the music that plays, the full, which ends up with Fernando Rey's character, Alain Chaunier, the importer, if you will, or the exporter of the drugs. He evades him. He gets into the train. He keeps tricking him. They play a game of cat and mouse, and then he tricks Hackman and gets in and takes off in the train. Awesome scene, awesome music. Paying tribute to the late William Friedkin, gone at age of 87. So I don't even know where to begin with this whole college realignment thing, this conference realignment. So I'm going to bring in Hawkeye Mike right now, just get it over with. Mike, how you doing?
Pretty good, Hank. How's it going?
Oh, gosh. You know what? I just don't even know what to make of all this.
Pretty wild stuff, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. It just seems to me, I mean, as you said, you're not in favor of it. I'm not in favor of it. But, I mean,
no,
who's in
no.
what conference?
No
now,
one asked
you know?
Me, though.
Yeah, no, nobody asked me either. I mean, I don't even know. Okay, so who's going where? So Colorado, I mean, first we got USC and UCLA to the Big Ten. That happened earlier this year or late last year. And then we've got Colorado bolted for the Pac, or for the Big 12. And then who else is bolted? A couple other schools.
Arizona State and Utah is my understanding.
Okay, so they – and then we added – the Big Ten added Oregon and Washington for 2025, I guess.
I have to say, I think it's not over. I think that there's going to be more shoes to drop, I guess you say. I mean, I don't like what's happened so far, but I don't think we're at the end of this.
No, I don't think we're anywhere close. You know, here's who I feel sorry for, believe it or not. I don't know why, but I feel sorry for the four schools left of the Pac-12, which are Washington State, Oregon State. Who are the other two? Washington
Cal
State, Oregon
Stanford.
State, Cal and Stanford. And Cal and Stanford, supposedly now, there is a supposed move for the ACC to try and pick them up. I don't know how reliable that is.
Will they change the name of the conference? I mean, how can they be the Atlantic Coast Conference if you've got
Cal
and Stanford as members?
But there's also been talk of them going to the Big Ten still. But I feel sorry for those four. I feel sorry for those four because, you know, and this is where I'm going with this. So you keep hearing that, you know, from people who are in favor who say, oh, this is great for the schools like, you know, somebody from Iowa actually said, oh, this is great because, you know, it just brings us the Pacific Coast market for recruiting and everything. Here's the problem. When you see what's happened to the four schools that are left in the Pac-12, it can have, that's the, you know, look at the profile of those schools. Look at the profile of those schools. So don't tell me it won't happen to Iowa or Iowa State or Wisconsin even. You know what I mean? I mean, at a certain point, they're going to take a look at certain teams and they're going to say, you know what does Iowa bring to us? You know, I mean, that day might come, you know, sooner rather than later. I mean, the farther we get from Jim Delaney, I can't believe I'm saying he's a traditionalist at this point, but I mean, given how much he was into expansion, but
look, I, to tell you how old fashioned I am, I wasn't really that thrilled about Rutgers and Maryland coming in.
I thought 12 was good. I wasn't that thrilled about Penn State and Nebraska. You know, Penn State first made it the Big 11 for several, you know, for gosh, 20 years almost before Nebraska was added.
They're at least a little bit more of natural fits. You know, the thing, and as I said, I'm old-fashioned, but I think you probably feel the same way. to me, the thing about conferences at the fundamental level is that they're regional.
Yes, exactly.
And when you see what's happened in the Big Ten and the Big 12, the SEC is still, oddly enough, still regional. You know, it's anything but regional. And to me, that defeats the entire purpose of a conference. I understand the desire on one. I understand. I don't. I think I've got. There's more. There's so many levels of where I have, you know, real misgivings about all this. But the first fundamental thing is it's no longer regional, and then also that combined with when you get to 18 teams. At what point does a conference become unwieldy, and then you have to naturally have some sort of subdivisions, and then those become like the old conferences, and which you know, so basically what you have, if you get to 20 teams or if you go to 24, we can talk about, you know, what where else it might happen. It's you're in like a league. It's like the AFC or the NFC or something like that. And, you know, which, I mean, I think we're heading toward three giant conferences, if you want to call them that, because I think what's going to happen, the Big Ten now 18 goes to 2024. At some point, the SEC is going to probably have to expand. And the Big 12 will just, you know, pick up the scraps and they'll expand. And they're already up to about, what, 16 now?
Yeah.
And, you know, with the additions they've got. But at what point does it just become kind of the theater of the absurd
with
the size and the lack of reach? I mean, the Big Ten, we grew up our whole lives. It's the upper Midwest conference.
Yeah.
And that's always what it was. And why is the West Coast incapable of maintaining a major conference? And the fact that it can't do that, which is why the Pac-12 broke up, because we can talk a little bit about that, but it's basically once Southern Cal and UCLA bolted, and one of the reasons that they did bolt before Oregon and Washington ever did was because they were having troubles negotiating television contracts and couldn't really do it, and just a feeling that they were going nowheresville out in the Pac-12. So, which begs the question of why has that happened? And I think it's because there is, for some reason out there, the rest of the country is pretty football, college football crazy, fill stadiums. They have trouble in a lot of those schools out there in the Pac-12 filling stadiums. I think Oregon and Washington maybe have done fairly well, although I wonder about Washington recently. Autzen Stadium in Oregon, they do. But the rest of the schools out there are, let's be blunt, you go on any given Saturday to a college football game out there, they're half full, which begs the question then, why is that? And is there an indifference or just a lack of enthusiasm for college football? I don't know what the hell is going on out there, because I think even UCLA and Southern Cal don't fill the Coliseum and the Rose Bowl on a regular basis.
No, they don't.
Change when they come into the Big Ten. But so the point is, why was the Pac-12 doing so poorly? What's the problem out there in terms of those that area of the country with college football? And do we really want to infect the Big Ten with some of these schools? It's just too big. There's conferences should be regionals, all kinds of fundamental problems I have with this. And what's the reason then for doing it? Is it just all about a sort of a perception? Because I don't know if it's going to be a reality. Maybe it will be that it's more money or somehow prestige for the Big Ten. But we already had these contracts negotiated now, which I'm excited about, actually, with CBS and NBC. And Fox.
Yeah.
I don't think that Oregon and Washington add anything to that. I'm not even sure Southern Cal and UCLA do.
Well, Southern Cal and UCLA bring a very large TV market. You know, that's for sure.
That's true. But remember also at a fundamental level out there in California, Southern California, yeah, now they've what's going on even with the NFL? The Raiders bolted, went to Las Vegas. For a long time, Los Angeles had no teams at all. No NFL
teams.
Now they've got the Rams and the Chargers back. We'll see. I don't know, you know. But what was the problem then? What's the problem out there with them toward maybe collegiate sports, maybe toward any sports, really?
Well, I think
we
forget, though, that there is a subculture in academia that hates any and all sports. You know, we saw it when we were at Iowa.
That's true.
You know, they rail against stuff. Yeah, it's been forever. They've railed against, you know, the commercialization
it's like we used to joke around about that. Remember that from Back to School, the Robert Downey character saying that football was a crypto fascist metaphor for war.
Yeah, exactly.
There's a lot of lefties out there that they kind of agree with that.
Yeah, they do. And not only that, they are, you know, there's a hell of a lot of money that flows through the Big Ten schools. It has nothing to do with football. Research grants, research partnerships, government and quasi-government, and you know all that. And it literally dwarfs the football budget. You know, contrary to popular belief. I think part of it is that you know from a political side, they see this money and. You know, what is it about somebody gets to Congress and suddenly they crave access to everyone else's money? You know, I think that's part of it. It's like, well, this is something that can be taxed or something that we can, you know, be a part of, get a piece of this action. I think that's a part of it. But, you know, there's even talk that Florida State and Clemson might be looking at the Big Ten, I've heard.
I've heard the same thing about North Carolina, possibly.
Yeah,
maybe even Clemson. Although I would have to think with Clemson, if they go anywhere, probably it's the SEC. But so then that's what I mean. We could be in a situation, and Notre Dame too. The Big Ten always wants them, and will always make room for them if they ever want to come in.
Sure.
I can see the Big Ten going to 24 schools. I mean, we could sit here and speculate on this, but. I kind of used to not think that was going to happen. Now I think it's likely to happen at some point. Maybe not in the next year or two, but in 5 years, 10 years, it will.
Yeah. So Boy asks the question, okay, in the chat room, okay, do you have more of West Coast games? He says, I know I can get a Boston College game or Temple or Texas Christian more than I can see my Bruins play. And at this point, the last contract that the Pac-12 had was going to be with Apple TV, you know, and that's counterproductive.
Well, right. It was a disaster out there. They could not negotiate a decent TV contract.
Yeah.
I guess there's just one attempting market. Right, right. Well, that's right, right. But I think even before that, though, Hank, when one of the motivating factors for Southern Cal and UCLA to bowl was because of a feeling that the conference was going nowhere, the Pac-12, and they were struggling to get a decent, you know, they didn't have contracts comparable with the television networks, comparable to what the Big Ten and the SEC were getting, maybe the Big 12.
And which is the weird part about that is, those conferences, if anybody is filling their stadiums, it's the SEC and Big Ten schools. Big 12 probably to a degree as well. ACC, Florida State, Clemson, Miami. But Miami's never been a school that has had, you know, packed houses, even in their heyday. I mean, it's, you know, there's a lot. And that would probably explain a lot of USC, too, in that, you know, there's just a lot more going on in those places for that people just aren't that, you know, there's just more going on. I mean, why is Northwestern in a huge market? Why are they never, you know, they've never really been full. In fact, in rebuilding their stadium, they're building it smaller, you know? So that's, I don't know.
Having problems in the Big Ten. You and I remember, of course, the good old days. We played everybody. Every year, for better or worse, and a lot of times it was for worse, you know, we would play Ohio State and Michigan. And even before all this, when we went to four, since we've gone to 14 teams, I think like Iowa's played Ohio State twice, maybe in the last 10 years.
Yeah.
Michigan, not much more.
People say it's your easier schedule. Yeah, and people say, well, it makes for an easier schedule. It doesn't really. It does in a sense, but
no.
You had
Southern Cal, UCLA, Oregon, Washington. If they were to keep like and now there's going to be an argument that they need to go back to a Big Ten West and East, and those are all absorbed into the West. It's hardly the Big Ten West. I mean, that's going to be a tough ride for somebody like Iowa when you add those four schools every year.
I don't feel as bad as I do for Purdue and Northwestern and Illinois, or maybe Wisconsin, who are going to be part of the Big Ten East now.
That's another thing. How is this going to work? How are they going to do this? I don't see how you don't go to some sort of a subdivisional type situation.
Think about local impact. I mean, Northwestern especially benefits far more from high-profile home games from a community standpoint than they do from a school standpoint. I mean, that brings it, when Iowa plays there, Iowans fill that town, Iowans go into Chicago and spend money. When Michigan and Ohio State both are off our schedule, that means no big, huge game for the Iowa City business community. Wisconsin, that's a day trip. I would bet 3/4 of the Wisconsin fans that go to that game don't stay overnight. Probably they might buy lunch somewhere or dinner on the way
home.
What you're touching on
is very much my main misgiving that I alluded to earlier about the regional and with that, the cultural aspect of college football that makes college football so great. And that is the Big Ten being an upper Midwest. We don't have the same culture and regional type relationship with these West Coast schools. They used to be kind of the enemy. You'd face one of them in the Rose Bowl if you ever made it there. Maybe on occasion you'd play one of them in a non-conference game. But they weren't us. They were out there on the left coast, and the Big Ten had this unique cultural regional feel to it there was a certain affinity and affiliation of schools that was cultural and, that's gone. And I just think that's kind of sad.
Yeah. And so what happens to the Rose Bowl now? Think about that.
It's just another trip out to UCLA, right?
Yeah,
The Rose Bowl had lost, let's be honest, it had lost a lot of its cachet, as have all the other bowls, to the extent that they matter only if they're part of a playoff. Now, we're going to a 12-team playoff. My argument has been, I think it's great that we're going to a 12-team playoff, which, by the way, there was enough momentous stuff going on next year with Oklahoma, Texas in the SEC, Southern Cal, UCLA into the Big Ten, and a 12-team playoff next year, that you didn't need to do anything else. It's already kind of a watershed year. But anyway, the thing is, you asked about the Rose Bowl. Well, except as it relates to the conference playoffs, to the national playoff, It doesn't, remember the year when Iowa lost to Michigan State in 2015? They went to the Rose Bowl. It was like a letdown because they came within a whisker of being in the playoffs. And Iowa didn't even hardly show up mentally for that game. Now we got – my argument now is with the 12-team playoff, which I'm fine with. Maybe we should go to 16. You don't need any bowl games. It should be like the NFL now. You either make – if you can't make the top 12, or let's say maybe at some point it goes to 16, you can't make the top 12 or 16, your season's over with, try to do better next year.
Yeah, I think there's a place for bowl games, non-playoff bowl games, in a pre-Christmas format. I mean, remember for a while you'd have like the, you know, it was something to get to a January bowl, but then suddenly you had like the Japan Bowl and the, you know, the Judo
Tidy
Bowl,
and, you know,
yeah,
they got so many bowls,
California Bowl, but they would play like on January 3rd. They would intentionally schedule for after the and it was like no, that's got to stop. That should have been stopped a while back. But so I think you can use some of the bowls as, you know, playoff games, you know, the bigger ones.
Yeah.
You can add the Citrus, the Gator,
but that's
the
my
Outback.
Point, though, is they're only relevant now, these bowls, in how they relate to the playoffs.
But the way you can do it is that you can then get, you know, your 7-5, 8-4 teams, some 9-3 teams, you can put them into, you know, some kind of bowl format, you know, the weekend before the playoffs start or whatever, or even do the playoffs, get them started almost right away, and then have a break.
But how many games are you talking about in a season now? I think the Big Ten's going to have to go with 18 or more teams. They're going to have to go to, right now, we're playing 9 conferences. I think you have to consider 10 or 11 conferences. You're going to have a giant conference. It doesn't make it. What's the point of it if you're not playing as much of the other members in every year as you can? So why not go to a 13 game regular season with 11 teams in the conference, something like that?
Yeah.
If we're having a 20 team conference.
Yeah, I mean it's going to change the, like you said, the regionality of it. I mean, you know, five years ago, 10 years ago, playing at UCLA would have been a big in-season, you know, inter-conference game. Now,
right,
it's just another Big Ten Saturday, you know, and it's, I mean, the Big Ten Network is loving this. Big Ten Network, and somebody made the argument that
there's commercial interest in media that love it. I think that's what's compelling it.
Yeah, somebody said Delaney started it all with the Big Ten Network, and there's a lot of truth to that, because every other network that's out there is actually just dedicated bandwidth on ESPN. You know, it's not an actual network. It's not an actual,
And by the way, what was the big gripe? What was the big gripe with the Big Ten Network among, like, say, for instance, Iowa? Well, we're not on enough because there's too many schools. Well, that's going to be getting worse when you go to an 18 or 20 team conference.
Well, but that's why the partnership with Fox became more fleshed out. I mean, Fox has always been a part owner,
well,
now, majority owner.
Right, and they've expanded it. They've expanded that, and then also you're going to have Fox, you're going to have FS1, you're going to have ABC,
CBS, and
I mean,
Peacock,
NBC, CBS.
And NBC. Yeah. So, but you know what? Yeah. When we were in school, remember that? When we were in school, we might be on a local affiliate one week, we might be on CBS another, we might be on ABC a different week, you know, so we're in a sense getting back to that, because I think, you know, ESPN became, I would almost say, anti-competitive in locking conference contracts up, but at the time, they were the network to be on. Now, not so much, you know, and as evidenced by the fact they're laying people off.
No, I mean, the Big Ten's pretty much going to sever its relationship completely with ESPN after next year.
Yep.
This year,
Boye
after
says,
this year, I'm sorry.
Boye says, bring the Hawks to UCLA. I mean, that would be a great trip, you know. But, I mean, again, during the season, you know, how many people from Los Angeles are going to come to Iowa City the second weekend in October, you know? I mean, that's going to be – yeah, that's going to – well, you know, here's another angle, and this is why I'm surprised about UCLA and USC. USC's contract with Notre Dame, I'm sure it's been brought up before, but – by other people, but that contract, if the game is before, I think it's October 15th, it takes place in South Bend. If it's after October 15th, by contract, it takes place at USC, because USC didn't want to play in South Bend in November.
Yeah.
And you have Notre Dame didn't mind playing in LA in November, but
it's not going to be able to do anything that cleanly when they come into the Big Ten. There's just too many schools, And so the big so these West Coast schools are going to have to get used to traveling to the Midwest in November to some extent, and late October. It's just going to happen, you know. But I mean, think they obviously they understand that. I just wonder here. Don't you kind of wonder this whole thing? I'd like to know a little bit more about what, like I said, what impelled this specifically.
Yeah, from a Big Ten standpoint.
Was there anybody at the administration level in the existing Big Ten schools that said, you know, this, I don't know about this. This kind of sucks. And, I mean, I I've heard rumors that there was some, not you know, obviously categorical objections, but there were reservations by some Big Ten schools about this, not enough to stand in the way, though. I mean,
I would guess,
you know, you get two or three schools don't like it. What are they going to do, right?
My guess, though, is that in one sense, think about this from like medical research. You know what? Having the University of Iowa Medical School do some partnership grants and research with UCLA Medical Center. Yeah, you don't turn that down, you know.
Well,
you don't turn something like that down, and it's a lot easier if you're part of the same conference. So from that angle, you know, you take.
Well, you know what? I hope I'm wrong. I hope that this really turns out. You know, a couple of years from now, and say, wow, this is great, adding all these schools. It's really worked out well. But man, I just have a lot of misgivings about this. But I hope I'm wrong.
Well, you know, I think things like. You know, share. I'm here. You know, we're reading that they're coming in for lesser share or reduced share, at least for a while. I mean, the way Nebraska did,
right,
the way Maryland and Rutgers did. What Maryland and Rutgers? Where? How do they feel special now? You know, for a while they were like, hey man, we're in the Big Ten now. Now, so is everyone else. You know, I mean, other than Washington State and Oregon State, you know, everyone else is in the Big Ten. I mean, it's literally. You remember? You probably don't ever follow pro wrestling like I did. For a while, in Ted Turner's organization, there was this group called the NWO. It was Hulk Hogan and a couple of guys pretended to be these outsiders. But, I mean, it got to the point where every week somebody new joined the NWO. So that, like, if they had, say, 100 wrestlers on the roster, if they had 100 wrestlers on the roster, 80 of them were in the NWO being bad guys. I mean, it became ridiculous. I mean, that's what it feels like. I mean, who's not in the Big Ten? I mean, it's...
Well,
you're
also here's the thing that'll really piss me off. If we end up in a situation where even Nebraska, I wouldn't say this so much about Nebraska, but we need to be playing at Iowa. We need to play Minnesota and Wisconsin every year.
Yeah.
And if that,
absolutely.
If that, you know, remember like that really sucked for a while when they went to that Legends and the.
We didn't play Wisconsin for four years.
Like 2 years in a row. That
4 years.
Sucked.
We didn't play for 4 years. Yeah.
I mean, ideally, they were going to do this before they added Oregon, Washington. We were basically preserved to play every year against Nebraska, Minnesota, Wisconsin. All right, Nebraska. If we were every other year with them, I don't think. But it's such a horrible deal. But we need to be playing Wisconsin and Minnesota every year.
Yeah,
I think, and this is just me, I think it sucks. I think it sucks if that doesn't happen. That's just the bottom line. That's my line in the sand kind of thing.
Yeah,
and I really feel like we should be playing Northwestern every year.
Yeah, and Illinois, frankly.
And Illinois. Well, now we've gotten away from playing Illinois a lot every year. We should.
Yeah.
Now, you know, we'll see. We'll see. I mean, if they go to, like, if you have 18 teams, why not have, like, 6 subdivisions or something like that? I mean, 3 subdivisions of 6 teams. And then you play the other 5 every year, and then the rest of the conference, the other 12 teams, you could at least play them every other or maybe every third year, one or two of them, something like that. It becomes unwieldy at some point, you know. What's the point of being in the same conference with the school and you play them once every 5 years?
It's meaningless. It becomes meaningless, definitely. So, hey, we're up against a hard end because I forgot to tell you I have a a dog obligation tonight. So
okay.
So we're going to head out, but we're starting to talk in the next couple of weeks. We're going to be talking more football. So be prepared.
Right.
Be prepared. Be armed
okay.
with info and predictions.
It's about to start. You know, I'm excited.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks for being on. I'll talk to you later.
You bet. Take care, Hank.
And that was Hawkeye Mike. Hey, folks, we're up against a hard break, like in 15 seconds, because, as I said, I had some stuff going on tonight. Have a great rest of your week. Have a great weekend. And in the meantime, be safe, be vigilant. God bless America. Have a good night, folks.